For the Wild is a listener-supported program. If you value our work, please make a tax-deductible donation at forthewild.world. Also, please rate us on iTunes so that we can continue to spread this content to a wider community.
The silence is broken by somebody crying, trying to be heard, never a word. Always the attitude, sort of your own, always alone. Wishing for something the world is denying. Out in the wilderness, somebody's crying. Somebody wishing for something to happen, wishing to tell, wishing to help. Someone was listening, someone who cared, never despaired. Someone to lean on and someone to trust. Who needs your assistance and finds your disgust?
Hello and welcome to For the Wild podcast. I'm Ayana Young. Today we are speaking with Dr. Sylvia Earle. Sylvia is called her deepness by The New Yorker and The New York Times, a living legend by the Library of Congress, and the first hero for the planet by Time magazine. Sylvia Earle is a pioneering oceanographer and explorer who has led more than 100 expeditions and logged more than 7,000 hours underwater, including leading the first team of women aquanauts back in 1970. Formerly the chief scientist of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, Earle is the founder of Deep Ocean Exploration and Research, Inc., founder of Mission Blue and Sea Alliance, and has authored more than 190 scientific, technical, and popular publications. She has lectured in more than 80 countries and appeared in hundreds of radio and television productions. In her work with Mission Blue, her not-for-profit global organization dedicated to exploring and caring for the ocean, quote, our planet's blue heart, she endeavors to inspire a sea change in public awareness and support for global network of marine protected areas, what she calls hope spots. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Earle, for joining us today. It's a great honor to have you on the show.
It's great to be on board.
Thank you. So I want to start off by speaking of this blue heart of the planet, the oceans. And in one of your articles, you write, people don't know that the ocean is in trouble. And even if they do know, they don't understand why it matters. And yet we've got the evidence that has mostly been learned in the last few decades since the middle of the 20th century. Evidence of the role of the ocean driving climate, driving weather, shaping planetary chemistry, knowing that 97% of the Earth's water is ocean, and that it's not just water, not just salt water, it's a living system, the biggest ecosystem, and it's continuous. It's not oceans plural, it's oceans singular, that embraces all of the land, whether it's islands or whole continents, end quote. So would you mind starting us off by speaking about the unity of the oceans as the heart of a living planet, and elaborate on how it drives climate and shapes the processes that uphold life here on land?
In recent years, we've been able to look at the world as a connected system. When astronauts first went high in the sky and looked back, it really brought together many of the disparate pieces. We've known for a very long time that the ocean is a continuous system, that it's one ocean, not really separate entities, but everything connects, and it all connects to the land, the atmosphere above, the air and the water, the land. But holding it all together is life that occurs in the deepest sea and high in the sky as well. But wherever there's water, there's likely to be life. Understanding that and really being able to connect the dots has never been more evident, never as possible as it has become in recent times. One of the reasons for this is the ability to connect with people and data all over the world, and to have the technologies that now exist to be able to crunch the numbers, to take the bits and pieces of evidence and see the patterns. We might have understood 1,000 years ago that Earth is home, and you could look up in the sky and see all those sparkly things that now we know more about what they actually are than we could know 1,000 years ago, or even 100 years ago, or even 50 years ago. The knowledge about the place of Earth in the solar system, in the universe, and how it is different from Mars and Jupiter, Saturn, any of the other parts of our solar system, and as far as we know, unique in the universe, it should give us cause for concern about how we are altering the nature of the world as a whole, but especially the ocean. The evidence now exists that did not exist when I was a child about the significance of the ocean to every breath we take, every drop of water we drink, that the water cycle has become increasingly clear. Where does water come from that's in the ground or that falls out of the sky as rain? Well, currently, the water cycle is driven by the ocean. And people should ask, well, where did that water come from? What is water anyway? Why is it so special? Children are really good at asking questions that everyone should be asking. You know, why does taking care of the ocean matter? Why are changes in the ocean a matter of concern? I do refer to the ocean as the blue heart of the planet, because like the heart that we have, each of us in our bodies, it drives our circulatory system. And the ocean, in effect, is the planet's circulatory system, that the currents that flow and the distribution of water, not just through the ocean, but into the atmosphere above that falls back from clouds as rain, sleet, and snow. Now we can see these things with new eyes, armed with evidence that has been acquired mostly in my lifetime, in the lifetime of people who now exist, that knowledge did not and could not exist before the 20th century and now going into the 21st.
And to continue in this vein of awe and appreciation, can you explain how the ocean is a repository of historical knowledge? And what can we learn about the past and possibly the future of evolution through a study of the ocean?
Diving into the ocean for me is like diving into the history of life on Earth, because essentially the major divisions of life as we know it today are still there. We look at the record as we're able to read it now geologically going back into time. There are many creatures that did exist more than 500 million years ago, and they're still out there. Sponges, jellyfish, the building blocks of life, the genetic material that is common basically to life itself. Big miracles of life, as far as I can see, are basically twofold. With the common chemistry that life shares, the DNA, the RNA, the recipes for the genetic makeup of all life. And of course, there are many variations on the theme. In fact, no two humans are exactly alike. No two cats, no two dogs, no two birds, no two fish, no two trees, no two leaves on trees. There's immense capacity for diversity given this basic common recipe for life. It's miraculous. Cause for, great reflection, I would say, and a sense of humility. But humans have the capacity to perceive these things, to see them, and to consider what it all means. There is within the ocean the diversity in terms of these patterns of life, divisions that we call phyla of animals. Essentially, we've identified somewhere between 30 and 35 of these major distinctive categories of animal life that have the underlying common ground of chemistry, but with distinctive variations that set echinoderms, the starfish and their relatives, apart from sponges and their relatives, and apart from the annelids, the variations on the theme of polychaete worms and other variations on the form of annelids, such as the earthworms that are on land in our backyards. And on through these many divisions, only about half of those major divisions occur on the land. Essentially, all of them are represented in the sea, either with living forms or with fossil representation. The history of life on Earth is out there in the ocean, and most of it is still around, there to be read, to be experienced, to be treasured.
Sustainability in most cases is a sham designed to avoid real systemic change and prolong the overconsumption our species wreaks on the rest of the world. Marine fish populations have experienced drastic declines in the past century. You published back in 2011 that 90% of large fish in the oceans are gone. And in the meantime, I've heard 93% now. Aquaculture, farm-raised fish, has been steadily rising over the last three decades to exceed wild fish consumption, which plateaued in the late 1980s and has held steady at those levels, roughly 100 million tons a year. So if that harvest level continues, how long do large fish have? And taking into account your knowledge of fish life cycles and all the facets of the war on the oceans, and human population dynamics, what is your professional prediction for the wild fish catch in coming years?
I did not make up those figures about 90% of the big fish gone. I just communicated the results that scientists who have analyzed the data, largely drawn from the fishermen's own records over many years, came up with that figure in about 2003, I believe. Analyzing just the trends, here's where we were, here's where we are, and looking forward, the projections suggest that by the middle of the 21st century, commercial fishing will not be possible, will not be viable, because the populations of the desired species for commercial extraction will basically be down at such low levels that it would not be financially feasible to do it. But when you look at the current status, it's not really financially feasible today to continue much of the fishing that is taking place. If, in fact, there were no subsidies, much of the high seas fishing, for example, is supported by taxpayers' subsidies from many countries. The high seas, that is the area beyond the jurisdiction of nations that claim out 200 miles, and nations with a coastline currently do that for the most part. But the high seas, half the world, 64% of the ocean, is beyond national jurisdiction and beyond the reach of traditional fishing. Most of the fishing that supports communities and families that has a long history is coastal. To go out as much as 200 miles is expensive. The fuel cost, the kind of ships that are needed to actually operate far out at sea, are larger, more expensive, and costly to operate. The reality of our current status of extraction wildlife from the ocean is that we're really good at catching and really not so good about understanding the basic ecology or the life history of most of the creatures that wind up on our tables. Most people are not aware that a tuna fish does not get from an egg to an adult as quickly as a chicken or a cow. Quite the contrary. These are relatively long-lived species that takes, well, for bluefin tuna, the figures that are most reliable suggest 10 to 14 years for an egg to get to the point where a mature fish is able to reproduce. And many of the fish that are taken today are not even at the stage where they have reached maturity. They're taking the young fish, and the big fish are mostly already gone. It's a recipe for disaster if you take the moms and dads. It can't be that it is the old fish that are able to reproduce. And it's not just bluefin tuna. It's cod. It's even the small fish, such as herring. If you take the older fish, the larger fish, they're the ones that are the most able to repopulate circumstances. But here's the thing. You know, most people do not think of fish as wildlife. They don't think of them in the same way that we think of songbirds and eagles and owls or bears and rhinoceroses and elephants and things. They think of fish as well, fish. That's how they're advertised. Fish and chips, fish chowder, fish, whatever it is, anonymous fish on a menu side by side with creatures that we can identify very specifically, like chicken or beef or lamb, or when we talk about pork, we know we're talking about pigs. But when you talk about fish, what kind of fish? There are 33,000 variations on the theme of fish, freshwater and marine together. But we kind of lump them all together with this anonymous characterization. We don't get Kentucky Fried Bird. We don't see advertised a mammal burger, but you do see this anonymous characterization. I'm going to have fish tonight. What kind of fish? Well, some fish are identified to name, like bluefin tuna or cod, although cod is a slippery term. It could be applied to dozens of things that are commonly known as cod or bass or sea bass, but whatever it is, they're not very specific about exactly what kind of fish are we talking about here. And we ought to know. And we ought to know how old these creatures are by the time they come to our plate. We should know what they've been eating, where they've been living. But rarely is that information available. It's not just true with fish. It's true with lobster. It's true with shrimp. There are many variations on the theme of shrimp. And quite a few variations on the theme of lobster. And sometimes in a market, you can see that the lobster comes from Brazil or South Africa or from New England or from California or whatever. But for the most part, the identity of those creatures that we label with the overarching term seafood is pretty mysterious. That's part of what gives a cloak of anonymity of we don't know what we're eating, who we're eating, or what's in that tasty chowder or those fish and chips. Fried fish, catch of the day. The catch is we don't know who we're eating. We should also know what the status is. And there are some guides that have been prepared by various sources, such as the Monterey Bay Aquarium guide. The New England Aquarium has a guide. New Zealand has a guide to ocean wildlife about best choices for consumption, which ones we definitely should not be consuming, which ones are better choices, and so on. But I think from my standpoint, I've come to a personal perspective of just leaving wild fish alone. When you look at the trends, how good we are at catching them, how the status of most is certainly not anything comparable to the health of the systems when I was a child or even 20 years ago. The decline overall is clear. We should give fish a break. We should give ocean wildlife a break. If you like them on your plate or if you want them alive swimming in the ocean, right now, it would make sense to just stand back. Unless you have true needs, if your sustenance is related to taking wildlife from the sea, then I think you're a special case and ought to be given some latitude. And that applies to coastal communities, to island countries, to people who really don't have the kinds of choices that those living in most of North America, in most of Australia, in most of Europe, and certainly in Japan and most of China. In times past, going back through the history of humankind, wild fish has not been on the menu of the great majority of people. It's a new feature that has come about as we have gained technological capacity to reach the deep sea, to reach the ocean in places that were inaccessible until the latter part of the 20th century, going into areas in Antarctica to capture fish that have never known humans as predators before we had the capacity to get to these places distant from where most people live, and into the deep sea, where fish had been safe until recent times, when we have technologies developed really in times of war to find submarines and things, we're now able to find fish and to target them with new gear that did not exist until the latter part of the 20th century. We're getting better all the time about finding, catching, and marketing ocean wildlife. The consequences, not just to those creatures in the sea, but the extraction of wildlife on this massive scale is having consequences to the network of life, to the ecology, to the chemistry of the ocean itself. So there's more than one reason why we ought to think carefully about the choices we make when we look at a menu that features fish.
It's really incredible to imagine using these tactics of war to find fish and all of the technology that's going into finding these last hidden treasures of the ocean. And to go back to what you were saying about the ocean communities of people, you know, people in China and Japan and people who rely on the oceans for their livelihood. And I was recently speaking with Paul Watson of Sea Shepherd, and I asked him this question, and I'd like to ask you as well. How can marine conservationists balance the unforgiving limits of biology and the needs of traditional indigenous fishing cultures or even settler communities that have revolved around maritime culture for centuries? You know, I can't imagine a solution that isn't complex and imperfect, but do you see a way forward coming into focus around this issue, or is it as unresolved as in land conservation?
I think the good news is, for the first time, we're armed with knowledge that could not exist before we had the technologies able to look at what the issues are, to identify the status of what's happening to the world, to zero in on the problems, and in so doing, be able to find some solutions. One piece of positive thinking that's happening right now is about the high seas. That's half of the world. The area beyond where nations, starting in the 1980s, really extended their reach, the nations with a coastline extended their reach out 200 miles, the exclusive economic zones, that the authority, the responsibility for managing these aquatic regions that are, you know, like the United States is now twice as big as it was before that extension into the sea took place. We have jurisdiction out over a new country that is mostly unexplored. It's not unexploited. We're taking fish, we're taking minerals, we're taking oil and gas, but we have not focused so much on how do we manage ourselves so that we don't extract beyond the capacity of this newly designated blue part of the planet, blue part of our country, in ways that can continue. The catchword is sustainably. Well, we can't sustainably extract fossil fuels because once they're extracted, they're basically gone. We can't sustainably take minerals because once we've extracted them, they're out of the picture. They're in another part of the equation, but they're not part of what had been in the past. We're finding that this is true with fish too. It's hard to extract without disrupting the systems that have taken all preceding history to put into place, and never in the recipe for their life history is there latitude to account for predation on the scale that we have imposed. Humans as predators take far more than the natural systems are prepared to accept and keep going on the same level that they have in the past. It's just common sense. You wouldn't expect a system that is fine-tuned over literally millions of years to be tuned in with some predation, some latitude for disease, some latitude for storms. But on top of all of that, humans have arrived with the capacity to extract levels of adult reproducing populations and destroy the ecosystems in the process of taking. Why would we expect them to continue reproducing on the scale that they have before we began to take on this extravagant level? I mean, it just doesn't make sense. So it doesn't take a scientist, it doesn't take a computer expert, it doesn't take a fancy model, all those are all useful tools, but it just look at it. It doesn't make sense that we should expect to be able to extract continuously at the same level we have in the past. Maybe we can take some if we're careful, if we respect what it takes, not just in the United States, but in coastal areas globally. Think like a fish. I've asked fishermen in the Gulf of Mexico and in New England, in North Carolina, around the world. Well, if you were a fish, what would you do? But what are the places that matter to you and your future? And the fishermen, who know fish probably better than most, say, well, you've got to take care of the breeding areas. You shouldn't be killing fish when they're doing what it takes to make more fish. And that's a problem because it's so attractive to fishermen when they see breeding aggregations to go out and catch these fat, healthy adult fish when they're in the process of making more fish. This has been a problem in recent times. So that grouper aggregations, spawning aggregations of snapper have been targeted for taking. And it's no surprise that the following year there are fewer fish, and the year after that, fewer fish. These aggregations have been destroyed. Places where fish had congregated, they're largely gone. in parts of the Caribbean, in the Bahamas. There are few still remain, and they should be protected. And in some cases, they are. People are beginning to wise up and say, when grouper get together to make more grouper, let's leave them alone and let them do this so that we can have grouper on our plates, as well as have grouper as a part of the ecosystem. So breeding areas, feeding areas, nursery areas, the fishermen are beginning, those who really care about having a viable source of sustenance for local consumption. But that is in a totally different category of fishing that is now really stripping the ocean of life. That's the industrial scale extraction of wildlife, not just to catch fish such as tuna or creatures that are taken to supply this increasing demand by those who are marketing seafood as if it's as common as chicken and beef and lamb and so on, but the extraction of wildlife for products, for oil, for fish meal. There's real concern about the growing interest in using fine mesh nets, going into the midwater areas of the ocean where small fish and small crustaceans and squid are important part of the chemistry of the ocean, about the cycles of life, about the nutrients that are transported from the surface into the midwater levels and into the depths below, carbon sequestration, the carbon cycle, the nitrogen cycle, the cycles of life that make Earth function as a viable system, not just for all the other creatures, but for us as well. We take the production of oxygen in the atmosphere pretty much for granted, whether trees on the land or phytoplankton in the sea. We have not really put on the balance sheet the importance of protecting these life support functions that nature heretofore has provided for free. We haven't thought about the cost to killing fish or the cost to cutting down trees beyond what we can see as the benefits. Board feet of lumber when you cut down trees, fish to be sent to market as food or products when we take clear-cut fish from the oceans. But what are we losing in the process? That is the cost-benefit ratio that we need to look at going forward and realize that there's a value to these natural systems that we need to protect and be mindful of, that it's not just what we can sell, it's also the cost, that it's not free. There are no free lunch. There is a real cost to the extraction of wild fish or shrimp or lobsters or whatever it is that we're taking from the ocean, that we have to put on the balance sheet before we make choices. And at this point, because we have neglected those costs for so long, that there's a big cost to pay. It's there, staring us in the face if we just are willing to take a look.
You see what careless love will do. You see what careless love will do. You see what careless love will do. Make you kill yourself and your lover too. You called me to weep, you called me.
Yes, there is a big cost to pay, and I believe the Anthropocene extinction event is that cost right now. Seeing massive amounts of species and what I feel is our relatives going extinct. And, you know, that leads me to the coral reefs and the Great Barrier Reef. And there was a lot of news this year coming out around the mass die-off of coral reefs. And I'm wondering, is all coral equally affected? Or are some reefs showing resiliency that potentially holds a key to making it through the bottleneck to a future that includes living reefs? And also, can you speak about the potential for coral restoration?
Well, coral reefs have come into headlines in recent times because they're an indication of what's happening to the ocean overall. Until, again, the 20th century, the latter part of the 20th century, the awareness of the existence of coral reefs around the world, like a jeweled belt that circles the globe in the tropical areas, and the advent of diving, scuba divers who are able to become witnesses and take images and share the view, the importance of coral reefs to tourism. People love to go and snorkel. The importance of coral reefs as critical barriers along coastal areas where they occur to serve as a buffer against storms, along with mangroves. And, well, you know, the knowledge of the value of these ecosystems to people who live on the land as well as to the health of the ocean, and why that matters to people who are by nature terrestrial. Now that people have come to value these systems, they're paying attention to what's happening. There are other systems in the ocean that are perhaps as important, but because they're less well known, their fate is not being considered with such concern. I'm talking about areas in the deep sea, or even the relatively shallow areas where trawling takes place. Those ecosystems are rich and diverse, full of life and important to the carbon cycle, but because they're out of sight and not given the same degree of concern or attention that coral reefs are, they're just not accounted for. There's evidence that on the order of half of the coral reefs around the world have either disappeared or are in a state of serious decline just in the last half century. Since I began exploring the ocean, I've been a witness to the changes. What's causing this sharp decline? Well, part of it is related to the warming trend that we began to really seriously see and document, show the evidence of coral bleaching starting in about 1980. And it tracks very closely with the increase of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, the warming of the planet, the warming of the ocean, and the impact on life in the sea. And because coral reefs are so beloved and in recent times have become so important, not just ecologically, but financially, economically, to nations because of tourism, and economically because of the role of coral reefs and the related systems, seagrass meadows and the mangroves, to serve as a buffer during times of storms, the value of coral reefs is beginning to be appreciated. The diversity of life in coral reefs, it varies from place to place. There's greater diversity in Indo-Pacific coral reefs than, for example, in the Mediterranean or in the Caribbean or many other places in the Atlantic. But the Indian Ocean is notoriously diverse globally. The Barrier Reef in the South Pacific, other the numbers of coral or the numbers of fish or the starfish or the polychaete worms or sponges or the related organisms, the levels of diversity vary. Certainly the species vary from place to place. And it's becoming pretty clear that the level of endemism in coral reefs is regionally pretty high. So that if you lose a coral reef, you don't just lose corals in a generic term, you lose specific kinds of corals, specific kinds of invertebrates that are unique to that area. So you're not just affecting the overarching term of coral reefs. It's similar to rainforests. There's no two rainforests are exactly alike, and the composition varies from place to place. But I guess the concerns about this serious decline of coral reefs overall is an indication that the ocean is in trouble. If the ocean is in trouble, it means things that underpin our existence are in trouble too. And we ought to listen up, pay attention, and be aware of what is driving the decline global warming is an issue. It's not the only issue. What we put into the ocean, aside from the excess carbon dioxide that is not only warming the planet, but is driving ocean acidification, that's looking back at us as the cause, the driver. What we're taking out of the ocean is also a factor. Studies that go back to the 90s, and actually before that, the awareness that what we take out of the ocean, sharks, groupers, the big fish, as well as lobsters and the small fish, all of the extraction of wildlife, the loss of diversity, the loss of the healthy functioning of the systems that make a coral reef what it is, that's having an impact as well. It's a collision of what we take out and what we put into the ocean that is causing an overall decline of systems that certainly include coral reefs, but they're not limited to coral reefs. Coral reefs just serve as a wake-up call. What's happening to them is noticeable. What's happening beyond that is less well known.
So coral reefs are like the canary in the coal mine, so to speak. And I think about when you were saying, you know, reflecting on what we're putting into the oceans and what we're taking out of the oceans. I was watching Mission Blue for the umpteenth time, which is a documentary that was about you and your work. And I remember you saying at one time that there was one oil rig off the coast in the Gulf, I think back in the 1950s or 60s, and now there's more than 33,000. And I understand that you were called to consult during the Deepwater Horizon disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. And I remember hearing that years later, the well was still leaking crude oil, perpetuating the dead zones and continuing to beat back bottlenose dolphins and crabs, snappers, pelicans, killifish, corals, and a lot less visible species. Now research is focusing on adjacent ecosystems like the salt marshes and mangroves, and more impacts are noticed, such as seaside sparrows, who took a hit when the crickets and spiders that they ate began disappearing. And each warm spell or storm that comes through, more of the settled oil is kicked up, bringing new waves of impacts. So I'm wondering if you could speak about the reverberating effects you may have witnessed during the Deepwater spill, or that you've learned about in the subsequent years. And also, perhaps areas you can direct the attention of researchers and citizen scientists who are remaining vigilant on the waters and land around the Gulf?
Well, those are a lot of big questions all at once. But I think, the good news is nature is resilient. The reality is there are limits to what we can put in the ocean, what we can take out of the ocean. I was outspoken in the case of Deepwater Horizon spill about avoiding, or at least using very precise application of detergents to dissipate oil only like in a great emergency. If a special area was at risk, if the oil continued to, but generally speaking, the use of dispersants, it just didn't make sense then, and it doesn't make sense now. The widespread use, and especially the deployment of these dispersants, effectively detergents, in the deep sea, around the wellhead. If oil is at the surface, there's some chance that it can be captured and in some cases even perhaps put to use. But once dispersed into the water column, it's not accessible. It becomes a part of the ocean. And fish can't escape, dolphins can't escape, jellyfish can't escape. They're just awash in harmful chemicals. So what function the dispersants did achieve was to avoid the appearance of oil at the surface. It looked like it was a good idea to make it seem as though the oil went away. Well, it didn't go away when dispersed. It just did exactly what the name suggests. It was dispersed into little droplets of oil and made it harder to recover. What can people do? Well, be a witness, observe. Do what scientists do. Observe carefully. Report honestly what you see. It doesn't take a university or academic training to be an honest witness. and an honest reporter of what you see, without embellishment, just here's what I witness, here's what I see. You can collect data. You can be a part of the solution in terms of being a voice to have areas in the ocean that we consciously embrace with care, to protect places where fish gather, that we know where many of the critical areas are, seagrass meadows, the marshes, and the coral reefs, to protect them, to be proactive about looking at what remains of healthy areas and to do what we can to restore places that have been depleted. Now, there are some efforts to recreate coral reefs in places where they have been depleted. Well, I'm much more in favor of taking the pressure off existing reefs, even places that have been damaged. If you stop killing the wildlife in those areas, stop taking the fish, it's amazing what kind of recovery can take place. Plenty of evidence. And when you stop killing and really start proactively caring, that although you can never go back to what was, you can make things better than they currently are by removing the pressure, by doing what we are able to do to give nature a break. Gulf of Mexico has very few places where fishing is not allowed. I mean, very few places where we have said consciously, let's give the fish a break. Let's give the ocean a break. Let's proactively give back to the ocean that has given us so much for so long. Maybe it's time to give it a rest and let nature do what nature does best. You know, trees can grow back once cut. Fish can recover if we stop killing them. Not to the same extent, perhaps, that they were 1,000 years ago or 100 or even 50 years ago, but a whole lot better than they are today if we just give them a break.
As humans, as ecosystem engineers, everybody should be taking up some type of proactive approach to this dilemma that we're in. But then there's these larger dilemmas like ice melt. And, you know, we've reached another milestone in the warming of the planet, and namely a large portion of the Larsen Sea ice shelf. 1 trillion tons of ice broke off into the ocean in Antarctica. And then the Larsen A ice shelf collapsed in 1995, and the Larsen B collapsed in 2002. And so now the Larsen C is in the process of breaking apart, which will open the way for glaciers to slide into the ocean. You know, I'd hope this event would triangulate the pattern that's playing out and put the skepticism to rest. But while skepticism is the last resort for the powerful, it won't go away. For the audience of this program, we don't need more disasters to convince us. You know, we're beyond that. And we're looking for radical ways to intervene in the spiral of chaos that this calving event embodies. At the other pole, the countdown to an ice-free Arctic is ticking. And the Arctic ice is really the last thread holding the climate together. And when it's gone, global average temperatures begin to rise rapidly, in water and on land. So You know, I tremble to ask what effects we can expect to see in marine communities from these unprecedented global changes.
We should look at these changes as evidence, as you say, that anybody can see. Well, actually, we can see it because we have the technology that enables us to gather data, gather the evidence, using satellites, using humans who are able to get to places that most humans do not get to, and then to share the view. The evidence is clear. Imagine if we did not have that evidence. We would be oblivious to these trends and not able to respond. The key is knowing we've got a problem. And if you don't know you've got a problem, you can't fix it. We're the only creatures on the planet with all the smart animals that are out there, the elephants, the smart birds, the smart horses, our fellow primates, whatever it is. I know some really smart fish, but they cannot either see the nature of the problems, nor even if they knew what they were, how to fix it. We are in some ways the planet's worst nightmare, but we're also the best hope. We have the power to change. We can make choices that will lead to addressing these obvious needs for concern. So what can we do? Everyone has power. Everyone can choose to do something that will lighten the load of carbon dioxide going into the atmosphere, or you can make a choice that increases the amount of carbon dioxide that goes in the atmosphere. You can make a choice to convert whatever land you may have, a little patch in your backyard, into something that is good for nature, or you can mow it down and have a very costly kind of impact on your little piece of the planet that added up with what actions others take around the world that ultimately add up to either a better world or a world that is not so good. Make choices about what you eat or what you choose not to eat. Eating a lot of meat has a big carbon footprint. Having a smaller amount on your diet or going to be a vegetarian means you're making a choice that is good for you and good for the planet. I mean, it sounds like, oh, I'm just one person, it doesn't matter. But it does. That's the point. Every choice adds up. And the footprint each of us makes, times whether it's a billion or 7 billion, it all adds up. So what you do and what you can influence others to do using your power to inform people to make better choices, that's the best thing that each of us can do as a starting point. Some people have tremendous power to do far more. If they're CEOs of corporations, if they're leaders in their community, if they're teachers. I mean, everybody has magnified power in some way or another. And the thing is to not be complacent or to not give up and say, oh, it's too big a problem. I can't do anything. I'm just one person. Forget that nonsense, because that is making a choice. If you choose to do nothing, you are part of the problem. You are adding to the negative side of the balance sheet. But by being proactive, what can I do will make a difference for the planet? And then inspire somebody else or somebody else beyond that. It's amazing how the changes that have influenced the world, influenced civilization through all of history, inevitably start because someone made a choice.
And Sylvia, you are an incredible example of putting your knowledge and privileges and your passion fully into creating a better world, let alone your explorations and your studies and your scientific findings, but also Mission Blue and the Hope Spots. And I'm hoping that we can, to close our conversation, if you would mind telling us about these Hope Spots and how you have stood up as one person and helped to create protected places.
The idea of using the term Hope Spot came about really in a conversation that took place at the National Geographic a few years ago, where there's a discussion about hot spots, H-O-T spots, places that have been identified by scientists as places that have, on the land mostly, that are high diversity and also have a high degree of threat. And the concept has given rise to efforts to zero in on these special places where if you protect them, if you take the pressure off, if you really look at high diversity and remove the threats that now are upon them, you might have a magnified impact on restoring and, well, first of all, protecting what we have of the legacy of biodiversity and the natural systems that are so important to the functioning of the planet, and restore what we can of places that have been depleted. So it just occurred to me that they're hot spots, but they also are hope spots, areas that, if they can be protected, provide a degree of hope. And I was thinking primarily of just another way of looking at these special places, but the idea kind of stuck that in the ocean we've begun, starting in the 20th century, to realize that the ocean is not able to really take care of itself given the pressures that humans impose. We have to proactively look at the ocean the same way we have proactively looked at the land. Early in the 20th century, national parks came into being. The United States was really a leader in this regard with the national park system starting in 2016. Other nations have likewise taken up the idea. You think about places for their natural, their historic, their cultural value to civilization. So national parks, great idea for the land, but an equally good idea for the ocean. Calling them hope spots, places that, whether they're regarded as, quotes, blue parks, like the Great Barrier Reef in Australia that came into existence in the mid-1970s, or more recent areas such as the Papanamakuakea area in Hawaii, first established as a blue park, if you will, a national monument by President Bush, and then expanded by President Barack Obama in 2016. These are hope spots, areas that both protect areas of high diversity and threat, but also a high degree of value in terms of protecting the nature of nature. Hope spots are really applied primarily to the ocean as our overarching term for monuments, sanctuaries, marine reserves, whatever they are, places that are still in good shape, like the pristine seas areas that have been identified with the National Geographic Project of that name, but also areas that are not exactly pristine, but given protection, respect, and care, can recover, can at least be better than they are at present if we stop killing things. Of particular value of those are those areas where full protection is given, not just management about how much or what kind of creatures we extract, but really full protection to give proactive care for large areas of the sea, where we say we're just going to give nature a break and let the wild things be wild, let them do what they have historically done the best, provide the underpinnings of life. The most important thing that we extract from the ocean is our existence. The biggest hope spot of all, well, you could say it's the planet writ large, all of it, is one big, mostly blue hope spot. But half of the world is in the high seas. Half of the living world is beyond the national jurisdiction of nations. It's the global commons. Suppose we just took a deep breath and said, we're going to give the high seas a break. We're going to protect for the common good of all people and all life everywhere to just stop the killing in the high seas. Only a handful of nations can reach the high seas now with subsidized support to be able to go and extract from the common treasury of life. How about if we just respect the high seas? And that is truly the heart of the planet. And Ed Wilson's vision, the Half Earth Project, of protecting half of the world, land and sea, as a way to secure protection for everything we care about, our existence, first and foremost. Well, you could start by saying every nation has a vested interest. Every human, every form of life has a vested interest in protecting the high seas, the global commons. In a stroke, we would benefit the whole world. And we could do this. The United Nations is currently deliberating the possibility of governance in the high seas. It would give authority to show some restraint to that part of the planet that benefits everyone and to restore health to the planet. It's within our grasp. It's within our power now. But wait 50 years, wait 20 years, wait 10 years, we will lose chances that are currently open if we act right now. Concerning hope spots, for more information on that, go to the Mission Blue website. Mission Blue is an organization that was started a few years ago, now collaborating with the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, IUCN, to accept proposals that people have about places they know and love. We're working with the diving community to identify and get training on how do you become knowledgeable about gathering evidence to provide images and information about places that have been identified. So far, more than 400 places have been nominated by going to the Mission Blue website, where they're being reviewed. More than 80 have been dignified with designation as hope spots and appear on a globe, are serving as places where you can upload data. And the number is growing. The number should grow with people who support the concept and are willing to volunteer their time and energy to support protection in places they love.
Thank you so much, Dr. Earle, for taking this time to speak with us and for your life's work. I find it so enlivening to hear about the hope spots and also this global commons. And I will do what I can to support that and this audience as well. So thank you again for spending this time with us. A deep bow to you.
Well, my deep bow back to you. And thank you for what you're doing to make people aware of the concerns and inspire them to care.
Jaybird's calling, my mind grows dry and thirsty as the memories linger, drifting on the wind.
Thank you for listening to For the Wild Podcast. I'm Ayanna Young. The music you heard today was Anne Briggs with Standing on the Shore, then Lulu Jackson, Careless Love, followed by There's a Sunny Side to Everything by Cab Calloway. Our theme music is Bow with Silence Returns and Like a River by Kate Wolfe. I'd like to thank our entire team at For the Wild, including March Young and Reach Out, our amazing producers, Madison Migulski, our research director extraordinaire, and Molly Lee Bove, our media director. If you haven't already, sign up for our newsletter at forthewild.world, where you can stay abreast of updates on the podcast, our webinars, and the 1 Million Redwoods Project, which will take us on a seed foray up north in a month's time. For the Wild is now a fiscally sponsored nonprofit that can take tax-deductible donations at forthewild.world. Each of your donations, no matter how big or small, makes a huge difference for us.